Now, this week, we're asking the question, why do Christians trust the New Testament? Or maybe we should also, maybe we'll restate it. Why should we trust the New Testament? I am right. That's what y'all have on your schedule, right, for tonight? Okay. And so for me, I start with the question, really, when we ask whether we can trust the New Testament, for me, that really boils down, first and foremost, to the question, can we trust the Gospels? Okay? Because for me, if we can trust and believe the Gospels, then the rest of the New Testament, I feel like there's a thread we can walk down from there, right? A thread of authority. Essentially, what we can do is say, well, it's clear that these were the rest of the New Testament is written by apostles, or at least people associated with apostles. So if Jesus is saying all these things are true, and he's giving these disciples this authority, these apostles this authority, then we can also then trust what they have to say. So it all really boils down to whether we can trust the Gospels or not. And tonight, a lot of what I want to talk to you about is from a guy named Peter Williams, who also happens to be British. I wish I had the book here for you, but I don't, because I've loaned it out to someone. So if you have my copy of Can We Trust the Gospels by Peter J. Williams, please return it. I will ask no questions, all right? If you've been holding it hostage, I just want my friend to come home. And so I've got to... Now, I want to say this, guys. This is something you need to understand about the people that spend time with me, live in my home, work with me. There's a book crisis approximately once a month in my life where I can't find a book that I desperately need in that very moment. Today was one. And so oftentimes, I have misplaced it. So I want to go ahead and get that out there, because I've accused you all of having perhaps stolen it already. I want you to know there's also a strong chance that I have done something boneheaded with it. But I think I'll let somebody borrow it. First mistake. All right. So I usually put stolen from the Library of Matt Alexander in the front of my books. But anyway. All that being said, I wish I had this book with me. If you have any interest in New Testament studies or going in any level of depth into believing, trying to think through whether you think the Gospels are true enough or not, I'm a huge advocate of this book. I love, I think it's called Should We Trust the Gospels? He Googled for, is it Should We Trust the Gospels by Peter J. Williams? Williams is a really smart guy. And so a lot of what I'm going to talk to you tonight, I got from his book. But there's so much more than what I'm going to share with you. So there are just a few things. I mean, I could, listen, there's so much ink that's been spilled on the reliability of the New Testament. There's a lot of evidential, there's a lot of evidence, there's a lot of evidence for, I guess I should say there's a lot of evidence in the evidential strain of apologetics for the reliability of the New Testament. I mean, there's all kinds of really amazing sort of, I think it was F.F. Bruce that wrote The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? It's a really helpful book, and there's a lot of really good stuff in there. I think Williams leans in on Bauckham. On some things as well. So, I mean, there's just a lot. So this is just a tiny little minuscule part of the whole picture. Keller's got stuff on the New Testament, and McLaughlin has some stuff on the New Testament too. So there's lots of stuff. So, but I wanted to kind of give you some things that I've felt were very compelling in recent years, having been very familiar with some of the older arguments for a long time. Like, for example, that I don't know if y'all have ever read, like, who's the guy that's like a Lee Strobel. Lee Strobel has some books that I felt, when I read them at least the first time, are very helpful for me on some of this stuff. So, for example, like, you know, people will talk about the Gospels being written later. I think Mark was probably written, all right, these are all off the top of my head. I think Mark's written in the 40s is the general consensus. John probably in the early 90s, and the other two somewhere in the middle. of those. So people will sometimes say, gosh, that's, you know, a 7 years or a decade. And in John's case, right, 50 or 60 years after Jesus died. But if you were to look at when sort of quote unquote biographies or works about people were written in ancient times, the gospel is written much closer to the life of Jesus than the typical work would have been written. Sometimes it's hundreds of years later, right? And so they were written very quickly, comparatively. You don't have a sort of publishing complex like we do today, right? You don't have B&H Publishing where somebody can go and write all these things and get it published within a year or something like that. You just don't have that in those days. So now, you know, we're used to there being a book on something almost the next week. You know what I mean? There's something published really quickly. That's rare for the ancient world, so we shouldn't hold this to modern standards. Some people struggle with the fact that there is that we don't have original copies of the Gospels, that we have copies, written copies. You know, the reality is that if you take all the, if you take any document of antiquity and you look, by the way, there's almost no document of antiquity that we do have original copies of, by the way. So we don't have like the original copy of the Iliad. We don't have the Homer first edition of like the Iliad, right? Or something like that. We don't have any, most documents of antiquity we don't have copies of. If you want to study Koine Greek, right, which is the Greek that was the language of the New Testament, like right now, if you want to study Koine Greek and you want to study, you know, that Greek in that time period, your best bet, whether you're a Christian or not, is to become a New Testament scholar, because there are more copies of the New Testament than there are any other documents in that age. There are thousands and thousands of copies. They corroborate. We have really good explanations for when they don't. Furthermore, if you were to take just quotations of the New Testament in other works besides actual copies of the New Testament, we can recreate the New Testament, except for, I think, two verses we don't have quoted in other things. And those corroborate with the copies we have. So there's I think what Josh McDowell says there, when it comes to evidence, this might have been Bruce, but when it comes to copies and texts reflecting the original text, we have an embarrassment of riches in the New Testament. So there's all kinds of different little morsels, but I wanted to kind of just talk about some things that I have recently found really compelling. Okay. Peter Williams has a great chapter titled, Did the Authors of the Gospels Know Their Stuff? And there's some tests we might run, okay, on whether or not someone was... So the question becomes, right, is there any evidence whatsoever that we can believe the Gospels are eyewitness records? That's what we're trying to figure out, okay? We want them to be eyewitness records. Is everybody with me on this? Like, we want people to have seen these things. They certainly claim to be eyewitness records at some level. So one way we would know if something was an eyewitness record would be the test of geography. So all gospel writers display knowledge of a wide range of localities, from well-known through lesser-known to obscure. Okay? And we'll get to more. So it'd be sort of like this. Imagine for a moment that you're from Wisconsin, and you're from Wisconsin, and you want to write a book about the South, and you say I'm gonna write a book about you decide you want to write a book about a pastor at a downtown church in a city like Gadsden, okay. And so you do some research and you're like, man, this, let's pretend I'm imaginary for a second. Somebody's writing this story, right? They'd be like, this guy, he lives in Gadsden. And then where could he be from? I don't know. Maybe Boaz. You could get there, right? Like, you could figure that out. But then if you start writing about this, right? There are lots of things about both of those places that if you live in Wisconsin, you wouldn't know, and you couldn't figure out from Google Maps. You couldn't figure out from Wikipedia. You could only figure out from having been here, right? So you might could say, this guy grew up in Boaz, and he moved to Gadsden. and lived in Gadsden, but then you wouldn't know necessarily exactly how we say things, how we talk about things. You sure could never tell the story about how actually this guy's from a suburb of Boaz called Double Bridges, right? And then you sure couldn't tell the story about how this guy's grandmother took him one time out past Double Bridges, going out toward Kilpatrick, and she took him to an area that had a little general store, and it had a post office route or spot there. And that name of that place was called Squeedump, right? And now listen, if you are from Wisconsin and you can come up with a way to say, and his grandmother took him from his house in Double Bridges and they drove through town and they went through Squeedump, and she told him that the guy that's on the radio, Beecher Hyde, Beecher Hyde was actually from Squeedump. So I don't know, this is a lot of narrow sand mountain stuff here, right? But that's the point that I'm trying to make. That's the kind of level of detail, you know what I mean? That's the kind of level of detail that the biblical authors reflect. It gets down to really narrow kind of things. It'd be like, you know, if you just said, I'm going to write a novel about somebody from this state or that state, most people would, if they're talking about Alabama, they'd choose Birmingham or Huntsville or Mobile or somewhere really well known. Well, there's levels of detail in the Gospels that go beyond that. So they display knowledge of a wide range of localities from well known through lesser known to obscure. Now, this is just a little piece of evidence, right, that points to these are people who lived in these places. Here's another example of why this is, I find it even more compelling. No gospel author gains all of his knowledge from another gospel because each gospel contains unique information. So it's not the same set of towns in every gospel, right? There's a lot of overlap, but at least each gospel has at least one unique place that wouldn't be reflected, that still, based on what we know now, reflective of the world as it was in those days. All the writers show a variety of types of geographical information. We'll talk about this a little bit more. They'll talk about bodies of water. They'll talk about roads and travel. They have all kinds of unique information. And the thing is, we have no knowledge of any atlas or book or anything like that where they could have gained this knowledge. Right? So let's just say this is written 200 years later from somebody who didn't live in these times. There's no place they could have gone. There's no source they could have gone to get all this knowledge, right? I mean, it'd be just like if 100 years from now you wanted to write about Gadsden in, 2026 or Boaz in 2004 or whatever else. It would be really difficult, right, to reflect someone's memories that lived there that time, because what source would you have where you could go learn these things and see these things? You almost have to have interviewed someone or experienced it yourself. Does that make sense? So that's the case with the gospel writers as well. They also, when you consider the test of geography, you also think about the way they understand bodies of water. Okay? Bodies of water. What do I mean when I say Lake Gadsden? What am I talking about? Come on.
There's shallow water over there on the right.
Exactly, right? Now, if you say Lake Gadsden anywhere but here, is somebody going to be like, oh, yes, that water over there across the highway from the mall? No. Across the interstate from the mall? No, nobody's going to know. I don't even know if it's Lake Gadsden on the map, right? But people here call it Lake Gadsden. There's lots of different things like that where there's a people talk about bodies of water and other things in a way that only someone with local knowledge would do. So here's an example. When they call it the Sea of Galilee, it reflects a local name. It's sort of like this. Imagine this. I lived in Mobile for a while, and it's pretty true for people here, us in North Alabama as well. But if you met someone and they said they grew up in Mobile, and you're like, oh, that's cool, that's great. And then later they're telling a story, and they're like, yeah, one time when I was a kid, you know, we'd gone over to Gulf Shores, and it was just so wonderful to play in the ocean. What would you do almost immediately? You're like, I don't know if that person's from South Alabama. Why?
It's the Gulf.
It's the Gulf, right? No, nobody calls it the ocean, right? They don't call it the ocean in South Alabama. They call it the Gulf, and we were at the Gulf, or we were at the beach, but they don't typically don't call it the ocean. Or you'd say, are your parents from Mobile? You know, or whatever. You know, those are the kind of things you would say. So when they call it the Sea of Galilee, you and I would call that a lake, right? But people who grew up around the Sea of Galilee their whole lives called it a sea because for them it was the sea. And it's often called the sea in some of the gospel authors. Now, one gospel author calls it a lake. Williams thinks that's because he grew up in a place that was closer to the actual sea, right? And so he's like, I'm not calling this a sea, you know? This is a lake. And so there's some of those sorts of reflections of accurate geography. The Gospels also know that Bethsaida and Capernaum are towns located by the Sea of Galilee. See that in Matthew 4:13, Matthew 6:45. This is a quote from Williams. Matthew and Mark know that one can go from the Sea of Galilee directly into the hill country. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all know that there is a Judean desert near the Jordan River. So there's all these sort of small pieces of geography, right, that you would only know if you actually lived there, if you'd actually spent time there, if you actually inhabited that place. There's also unique knowledge, not only of bodies of water, but in terms of the geographical test, there's also local, historically accurate knowledge of roads and travel in the New Testament. I find this kind of thing really compelling. When you come to Jerusalem, you say you're going up because Jerusalem is the highest city in the area, right? So we're always going up to Jerusalem. It's sort of like if we were to say, yeah, I'm going down to Boaz later, right? Or I'm going up to Birmingham later. It just kind of sounds weird, right? Because we go down to Birmingham. Is everybody with me? And we go up to Boaz because Boaz is up on the mountain. And Birmingham is south of us. And you know, Boaz is north. Now, there's all sorts of ways and places where how you go up or down or how you think about directions is really unique, right? It's interesting that when you're coming to Jerusalem, you're almost always coming up to Jerusalem. But when you're leaving Jerusalem, you're always going down from Jerusalem, right? Because of the reflection of the height. It's just the kind of knowledge that you would need to have to include. It'd be sort of like understanding, like if you were writing about New Orleans or something or whatever, and if you said, we went west until we got to the West Bank, right, or whatever, it wouldn't really make sense because the West Bank in New Orleans isn't really west or a bank. And so there are just unique ways we talk about things, right? Even the way cities are laid out, the way we talk about a midtown or a downtown or whatever else. Interestingly enough, depending on what part of Gazan people live in, right? Some people call coming downtown. Other people call coming downtown Gazan going uptown. And I've encountered both. And I think a lot of it either has to do with the culture you're from or how your family said it growing up or what part of town you've lived in. And so even then, right, there's like a sense in which there's a carefulness that we have to have in reflecting a place. It really, speaking of New Orleans, let me just say this. It reminds me of this book I love called Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. It's a book set in New Orleans, and it reflects so much of the city in the 60s when he wrote it that only someone who lived in New Orleans at that time could have written it. It reflects all kinds of different aspects. And so the same sort of pastiche of knowledge is evident in the Bible. Then you start thinking about, so one thing William says is, well, perhaps it's just easy to guess that you usually go up to the Capitol and go down from the Capitol, right? Not really in Alabama, but still, let's just grant that point for a moment. He says there's another example of like somebody's going from Cana to Capernaum, which is a drop in elevation, and that's described as going down. It's just interesting that if these are people making this up years later, right? Four different people writing these things years later, it's interesting to think that they would have gotten all the geography right this consistently. Okay, it's just there's some evidence there. Brant,
I was late, so I apologize. I remember addresses, but like in the modern context of like apologetics, are there still big camps of people who? And obviously, there's huge camps of people who think that Christ was not, or Jesus wasn't the Messiah, or whatever else. But is there still like a contention of? Is this like a? How many people out there are still saying it's like the whole thing?
Oh, a bunch. I mean, and here's the thing, like, do I know, are there, like, that? I don't know exactly with scholarly people how many people feel that way, right? I mean, I think people who have studied it, there's a lot more who would probably, I think at this point, say that there's some level of accuracy in the New Testament. But basically what the most popular argument would be, in fact, you know, we've talked, Brent and I notoriously love the liar, lunatic, or Lord argument, the trilemma from C.S. Lewis. Peter Williams actually, interestingly enough, added a fourth L to that called legend. And he says that's the more popular notion right now, is that these are legends that developed around Jesus. Okay? So we have to... Well, yeah, I mean, I think most people believe Jesus was a person in history. Yeah. But not that the... Right. Sure. I think what people would say, though, Brent, like, okay, I'll just pretend, like, let me just put my skeptic hat. I would say, sure, yeah, I mean, I think there's probably some stuff that's not true about Bonnie and Clyde, right? But those people aren't advocating for legislation based on something they said. And so, you know, that's what I would say if I was a skeptic. So people would say that the stakes are a lot higher in this legend, quote, legendary figure. So over the years, there have been, like, groups that have tried to get down to what they would call the historic Jesus, the man behind all these things. I think very few people would say Jesus didn't exist at all, that there was somebody. There might be some people, Brent, I don't know how many. I think I've heard something about maybe it was a group of people and they kind of, but the way legends work, right, where that happens. So yeah, there are people, and there are certainly people who would say that the Gospels are not a reliable source for us to understand who Jesus of Nazareth was. That they're biased and, in some cases, people think fabricated. A lot of people think written hundreds of years later, sometimes 300 and 400 years later, people think these were written. So these arguments, right, sort of cut against a wide swath of those challenges, because it'd be really hard 400 years later to write, you know what I mean? Like, it'd be really hard to write 400 years later with this kind of level of accuracy that coincides with contemporary literature in this consistent of a way. I mean, so you're talking about these people having to be the most brilliant writers that have ever lived. Do you know what I mean? Which for me is sort of like, I have a harder time believing there are these four brilliant people in 400 AD that basically had the Old Testament memorized and found all these sources to be able to figure out what Judea was like 300 years earlier, and they're smart enough to keep all their stories straight, keep all these kind of things consistently on these incidental things. That for me is harder to believe than how I think they lived there and saw this.
But there's still a lot of people who believe outside of the resurrection and both like get behind the historicity of the Gospels, just not, they may be atheists.
Maybe some, I don't know, I mean, honestly, dude, like, I don't know anybody who has I'm not aware of a lot of scholarship that would have a high view of the historicity of the Gospels who didn't also believe Jesus is Lord. There are some, I'm sure, but not a ton. They would believe some of it's true, right? I mean, they believe something about it's true. They would just feel like, but like almost everything, there's a spectrum on it. And I'm not a professional apologist. I'm frankly, sadly, not kept up with like, I don't have time to keep up with the like scholarly literature. Probably like maybe I should. Maybe I shouldn't say I don't have time. That's not been my top priority in the last decade, is staying up on this kind of level of scholarship. So I don't know exactly the full lay of the land, but there's undoubtedly people for whom like they don't believe in the resurrection, but not just because of that, but because they feel like the Gospels are fantastical. But then I'll also say that most people out there that don't believe have some level of skepticism about the New Testament. You know what I mean? Like some level of skepticism about the Bible. I mean, if you're just like, yeah, man, it's true. God wrote it. I believe it or whatever. It's sort of like, why aren't you a Christian? Do you know what I mean? So, yeah.
They may believe that he's a real figure, but like they might not believe he fed 5,000 people.
Yeah. Right. And what I'm trying to drive at, and what I think Williams is trying to drive at, why I find this important and pertinent for what we're talking about, is that if you're sort of like, oh man, how could you believe, and maybe we'll get to this in a second, how could you believe that like, no, we will get to this in a second, but I'm glad you brought feeding the 5,000, right? Like, how could you believe you fed the 5,000 or whatever? Like, that's crazy. And so what I would want to say is like, and we'll get to this, is actually about the feeding of the 5,000, is like, why would they go, like, how do you go to this level of detail on things, right? Like, to getting all these things down pat, all these things, and then all of a sudden, when it comes to talking about X or Y that happened, I've got all the geography right, I've got all these things accurate, he was there, and you're telling me all these people had a mass psychosis event that convinced them that a guy was actually God, when there's nothing in their worldview, nothing in the world. There's no social gain to it. It's actually, on face value, going to literally ruin their lives to believe this, right? Apart from the belief that if you don't believe Jesus is Lord, like they're ruining their lives, ruining their family's lives, and eventually dying for this. Like something has to account for your, you know, what I would say is if you were like a skeptic, I would say something has to account for your belief that all these details can be remarkably accurate except for the things you just have a hard time believing. I'm just saying, if we have a problem here, we're going to smell it somewhere further out. You know what I'm trying to say? Like if something's rotten in there, you're going to smell it before you get to the thing you don't like. That's what I say. And I'll talk about that just a little bit in a second. There's some specific knowledge that's evidenced by the words attributed to Jesus. This is a quote from Williams. And I'm going to read a long quote here because I find it compelling. And listen, I don't know. We're not talking about this every week. We're not getting in the weeds like this every week. So y'all might all be like, this is ridiculous. This is boring. I already believe the Bible's true. Just wait till next week. We'll figure it out. But I find this stuff really compelling. I think this is the book. This is the book I told y'all a few weeks ago that I read and I realized maybe I had some doubts I didn't realize I had. These things were really helpful for me. Jesus says this in Luke 10, woe to you, Chorazin or Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida, for if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago, sitting in sackcloth and ashes. But it will be more bearable in the judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? You shall be brought down to Hades. So, Williams goes on to say, Jesus upbraids three Jewish towns or villages, Chorazin or Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum, contrasting the first two with the Gentile cities of Tyre and Sidon. The little-known village of Chorazin or Chorazin is in fact on the road to Bethsaida and just a couple of miles north of Capernaum. As far as we know, there was not a single literary source that could have provided this information to a gospel author. In other words, there's nowhere where these three, you know, they don't have Google Earth, okay? Just as a quick reminder. And so those three towns, right? It'd be literally, right? Like us saying something like, woe unto you, you know? It would be legitimately almost like Boaz, Sardis, and Douglas or something to that effect, right? Where you've got one more well-known town and then maybe another medium and another less known or something like that. Or maybe even less well-known than those. But there's nowhere that we have any source of where somebody could have gone and researched and said, oh, those three towns are close to each other, right? Chorazin is very, very unknown place. So that's just an example of when Jesus says this, it feels like someone who really lived in this place saying that, right? It's a piece of evidence to that end. Here's something else that where the Bible is, it really gets well, really nails it. It's the names of people. I wish I had the charts to put up for everybody. The names of people. Now, if I were to write a book about Gadsden in 1960, I probably would not be able to just use the names of all the people I know in the book, right? somebody walks in and they walk into the hardware store and they're like, "Hey, Aiden, how are you doing today?" You know, and it's sort of like that's a contemporary name, right? There's probably not a lot of people named Aiden in 1960 or whatever else. So what I would have to do, if I wanted to write a book about that, I'd have to go look at the birth records and just get a list of what the most frequent names were, right? And then as I'm writing, I'd be able to put those names in. And what I might could try to do is try to have those names occur at a similar frequency. Well, that's really hard to do. I don't think most novelists do that because we don't know, right? Well, in his book, Williams has a chart that shows the percentages of names of people in Palestine, according to birth records and other literature from the time, and the percentages that they occurred in real life, and then the percentages they occur in the gospel, and the numbers are remarkably similar. So Mary or Jesus or Joseph or all these names, they're not out of the ordinary for that time. And you might say, well, yeah, somebody could have done that, or what if it was just a Jewish person in another area writing these books? What's interesting is that those percentages are unique to Palestine, and they're unique to Palestine at that time. There were Jewish communities living all over the world, but if you compare the numbers in Palestine at the time to the numbers in, for example, Egypt at the time where a diaspora group lived, the names are very different and the numbers are very different. So someone who happened to be a Jew living in Egypt couldn't have replicated those percentages. Okay, I find that sort of evidence really compelling, that this is something that was written during that time. Here's something else that Williams talks about, and it's undesigned coincidences. Okay, so these are places in the Gospels where there are coincidences in the evidence that would have been essentially impossible to create. So here's an example, Martha and Mary. All right, somebody tell me, y'all know who I'm talking about when I talk about Martha and Mary, the sisters? All right, what was Martha like? She's busy, right? She's actually. And what's Mary like? She's a little more laid back. She's contemplative, right? She's not as much of a go-getter. So Luke and John have different stories that both talk about Martha and Mary, and they're independent stories. One didn't get one from the other, right? It's two different stories. But in both of those stories, there are two different stories, but in both of those stories, Mary tends to sit while Martha acts, right? Now, if you think about it, notice what Williams says. Williams says it like this. There's no obvious reason to conclude that one author has copied the other, but the two narratives present the two characters in ways that accord with each other. So what we'd have to do if we believe the Bible wasn't true or whatever, we'd have to believe that either Luke read John or John read Luke, and John intentionally is at Patmos, I guess, and he's writing this gospel, and he's like, I need to create another story that makes them look this way. So, well, that to me is more far-fetched than these two guys knew the same two women, right? These two guys knew the same two women. And it's just a little piece of evidence, I think, it's an undesigned coincidence that demonstrates the historicity, the historical nature of these accounts, and the eyewitness nature of the accounts. Okay, number two, the son. How about this? Here's another undesigned consequence: the sons of thunder. Okay, the sons of thunder. There's nothing in Mark, so the nicknames mentioned in Mark, right? There's nothing in Mark that explains why they're called the sons of thunder, really. We're just told they're called the sons of thunder. In fact, there's really nowhere else where you see them acting a certain way, except you have these brothers in Luke 9, right? Luke's gospel saying, Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them? Now, I love the idea. This is fun for me in a lot of ways, right? I love the idea that for just ever since they said that, Jesus never let them live it down. He's like, they, y'all remember the sons of, well, who are you today? The sons of thunder, you know, wanting to call down fire from heaven or whatever. I think Jesus is aggravating them a little bit, and because they're hot-headed in this moment. But you see the way that in this situation, Luke sort of sheds some light on Mark, and Mark sort of sheds some light on Luke. And these are, again, unintended coincidences. In other words, if somebody's lying to you, the first thing you start to do, right, what do? You ask questions. And you say, what was that guy like again? You know? And then one person says what? Oh, he was really shy and bashful. And the other person says, oh man, he was so outgoing. And then what do you say? Well, which is it? Something's not adding up here, right? It's just interesting, and I find it really compelling in the other direction when the Bible does add up really well on some of these kind of things. Okay, there's two miracles that are in all four Gospels. Anybody know what they are? One's easy. Resurrection. All right, got that. Yeah, resurrection's in all four. That's a biggie. The other one's the feeding of the 5,000. Is in all four Gospels. Mark talks about the area in which they gathered, and Mark says there was the grass was green. He talks about green grass, okay, at the feeding of the 5,000. John says there was much grass there. So you've got much grass and you've got green grass in the description, okay? Is everybody with me? John mentions that the Passover was approaching. So Peter Williams pulled the rain charts for basically 26 to 36 AD, right? And pulled when Passover would have been. It would have been basically at the end of March or the beginning of April every year in those years. And the 5 months before the end of March and the beginning of April for over a decade, every year was the five rainiest months of the year. Okay? So, again, you may say, well, this is not like a slam dunk answer. And I totally agree. It's not a slam dunk answer, right? But it is interesting to me that when you look at these kinds of details, the kind of details that are the easiest to mess up, okay? And listen, I'll be the first to admit, we can talk about some of the seeming contradictions in the New Testament. There are challenges. Don't get me wrong, there aren't challenges. But those are the things I feel like, the things that I read and I'm like, ooh, that doesn't quite line up. Those are things that would have been easiest to fabricate. You know, these are the things that would have been hardest to fabricate. Saying there was a lot of grass. I mean, it would sort of just be like any kind of novel you read or anything like that that's set somewhere you've been, you can tell if someone's been there. You can tell if someone's experienced it or not. And the same is true here in the Bible. So Passover would have always happened after the five most intense months of rainfall. Also, in Mark talks about how Jesus and the disciples had to move because there were so many people coming through the area. Not just coming to see Jesus, but coming through the area, which also would have been suggestive of the fact that this was right before the Passover, right? As crowds were coming. I'll tell you something else. Passover also, this is something William says, and I find this compelling. Passover also happened typically after the barley harvest. And it's interesting that the gospel authors note that the boys' loaves were barley loaves, right? So you may look at this and say, what? You know, like, this is not... I mean, no one of these little things is something we're going to like, see, believe Jesus is Lord. But what it does for us, I think, as Christians, is it gives us resources for our own faith. But second of all, if we ever have somebody who's like, oh man, that stuff's just made up. That stuff is just fairy tales or whatever else. I feel like we can say something like, you know, I understand that you think this is a fairy tale, but What if I just handed you this book and we read it together and you could tell me if you feel like there's not some clarity that something in here is reflective of history. Something in here is reflective of something that really happened. There's lots and lots and lots of evidence that these were eyewitness accounts that you don't have happen in fairy tales. You just don't have that kind of attention to detail in fairy tales. You know, there are whole... We don't even do that well at this kind of stuff now. When, you know, if somebody makes a movie, they have continuity departments. Is everybody, you know about this? So to make sure there's continuity through the whole movie, some of the big franchises have huge continuity departments, right? Like Marvel. I mean, to try to make sure they don't... But then any film that gets made, especially a historical film, they're going to be looking to try to make sure that whatever car's being driven was actually made by then, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we still mess it up with billion-dollar budgets, right? and with people that have the internet and people that have jobs that are dedicated to this sort of thing, well, you'll still sometimes see something, people reference something or say something that's historically implausible for that moment. It's fascinating to me that you don't have any sort of contradiction that I'm have any awareness of in the Bible, in the New Testament at least. I don't have any awareness of that happening anywhere where any of these kinds of details get bungled up. And so I would want to counter some of the concerns that someone might have about seeming contradictions with how congruent the Bible is with itself in so many ways. Okay, any questions about that so far? I don't know if that translates well from that book or not, but I find it really compelling. There's some of that evidence. Any questions or thoughts on that, y'all? Kind of overwhelms me a little bit too, thinking about how much this guy's read the Bible. You know, it's just amazing. And compared it. If you're into charts and stuff, you know, it's a great book. There's a lot of charts in there. I'm not a big charts guy, but I like his charts. But if you love charts, you're always like, the one thing that frustrates me about reading and studying the Bible is that there's just not a lot of charts going on. You know, Whitney's kind of a little chartier than I am. And she's a Excel kind of gal. And so anyway, if you're into that kind of thing, which I'm not, you might like that. But I do love that book. I think the other question we have to ask is, as we think about the New Testament, is if the New Testament's true, and I think it is, and if it's reflective of historical data. Brent, what I was going to say is, like, let me back up real quick. You know, with the green grass, the much grass, you just think about all that evidence that's kind of presented there, right? The barley, like all these things that are reflective of reality. And the point that Williams makes in this book is, like, at some point, right, you've got to say, well, this information got poisoned at some point. Well, it's perfect, literally, up to the miracle, right? Like, all the data, everything, there's no poison there, there's no problems there, up literally until the miracle. And so what I would just say is, like, why would we think that all this would be accurate and then he would just ba-doop, drop a little miracle in there? He's gone to all these, I mean, the gospel authors have gone to all these great stakes to demonstrate these details. Why would we trust those details but not trust the others? That's the kind of thing I'd want to say, is that at some point, right, these things become important, because if everything's accurate, data-wise, right, and reflective of truth, and you said, and we're talking to some friend who doesn't believe, and we said, if this was just a parable about sharing, where it was actually 100 little boys that gave their food and helped feed everybody or whatever else, would you have any problem with it? Would you think it didn't happen? Well, of course not. Well, I think there's a chance in which you might just be prejudiced against the possibility that a miracle would ever happen. Right, and I would say it's not pure reason for you, right? Because all the data seems to point to this being an eyewitness account of something that actually happened. There's no evidence in it except there's something in there you don't like, that you have a preconceived notion it can't be possible. Well, that to me is more biased and prejudiced than the preacher saying I think it's true. Over the years I feel like I've done my best to convince myself it's not true. You know, I dig into it. I really want to know, because I don't want to get up and preach and tell people to give their lives to this, and then it turns out it's just a bunch of hooey. You know, I don't like that.
Okay, let's say one gospel said 5,000, one said 4,000.
Well, I think there's two feedings, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but my point is, like, it's like the narrative can still be true. I mean, because even me and you are, sometimes personalities, like, you know, like, some people are extreme, exaggerated. Like,
sure.
I would say even if the details weren't all the same, that still doesn't necessarily take away from the possibility of this.
Yeah, sure.
Even more so, going back, I know when I'm in the Old Testament, but, like, I've heard people say, you know, was there two of every animal in the whole world on the Noah's Ark. Like,
right.
If there wasn't, I'm done with everything.
But yeah. Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I think that's fair. I think when I'm having conversations with some people, I'm going to say, hey, let's focus in on, like, on the gospel. Like, you know, I'm not really talking about, like, evangelism strategies so much in this class. Because, like, with different people, I'm going to talk about some of these things differently, right? For some people, I'm going to try to just hone in on the resurrection, which we'll talk about. We'll talk about a lot in the next couple months. Not just in here, you know? It's resurrection time. So, you know, for some people, I'm going to do that. For some people, I might need to get in the weeds on some of this, right? Like, for other people, you know, they're going to want to camp out at Noah's Ark or something like that for a long time, and or an axe head floating or something, you know. And for those kind of people, what I'll usually say is, well, you're not focused on the most frustrating and offensive part of the Bible. The most offensive part of the Bible is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's the hardest verse to believe, right? If I can get past Genesis 1:1, I can get past a lot. But the real challenge, right, and what cuts against us the most is that we are owned by someone, right? That we're beholden to someone. We have a creator. That's frustrating for us, a lot more frustrating for us than even us as Christians would like to admit it. So the other thing is, with, like, quote unquote contradictions in the New Testament, of which there are some apparent contradictions, I think they resolve really well, better than a lot of people would say. For me, the thing about those is there's not one answer to them, right? Each needs its own answer. So I can't really give, like, a blanket statement or whatever. I mean, honestly, I really do think, I mean, just preaching through two Gospels now, almost knowing Matthew, and as you preach through Matthew, you deal with some of those contradictions. And McLaughlin talks about this in her book. I think one thing that we have a hard time with is just believing some things happen twice. Well, I'm like, I mean, things happen twice sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if y'all have noticed this, but sometimes things happen more than once. And so, I don't know if you notice this about preachers. Sometimes we say the same thing twice. You ever notice this? Sometimes we say the same thing 1,000 times. You know, we reuse our material. You know, Jamie's a salesman. Jamie, you ever reuse any material?
Never.
You know, I'm sure there's people that get bits in the dentist chair. You know what I mean? And we've all got sort of things we say, things we do, right? I'm from a family of car dealers, and so there's all this kind of, I don't know, are any of y'all big Jerry Clower fans? Jerry Clower was a traveling salesman, right? And, like, he kind of started his stand-up career by having these bits he did with people he was selling fertilizer to, right, I think. And so, you know, one day I'm sure there was somebody had a monkey in Mississippi, you know? And then years later, this turns into a monkey that hunted raccoons with a pistol, you know? And so there are bits, right, that people have. And Jesus is an itinerant teacher. So I do think there's a sense in which, A, Jesus was going to be saying all, I mean, John says all the books in the world couldn't hold everything Jesus said, right? So he's repeating himself often. I think there are situations where there, you know, I don't feel this strong necessitated belief that every single thing that we have is the words of Jesus in the New Testament is a direct, exact quote. We talk about the, when we talk about some of these things, we talk about the exact voice or the spirit of the voice, right? And so, I don't think that, like, the Sermon on the Mount, I think it was a lot longer than what we have in Matthew, right? But I think under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, Matthew's able to distill what he's saying in those ways. Now, I think probably most of it is direct quotes, right? But it's not everything he said during the Sermon on the Mount. So I think there's repetition. I think there's places where he said it this way this time and this way another time. I think there's times where one time he feeds 5,000, another time he feeds 4,000. I think there's two anointings. I just think there's different things that happen, and sometimes they're pretty close, but there's enough differences, right? That for me, it's If I don't come at the Bible assuming it's not true, then something happening twice or a similar thing happening, two similar things happening, for me feels more likely. I mean, if you think about your life, sometimes there are things, there are patterns in life. Sometimes things just happen more than once. Sometimes you do the same thing more than once. I never saw the disciples get anything the first time they heard it or saw it. So I would imagine Jesus did lots of these things multiple times just to try to hammer the point home. I mean, honestly, this is it. But I'll have time for one more question maybe. But I mean, I sometimes say as a pastor, your whole life is basically, please don't take this offensively because I'm the same way, but so much of what you're doing as a pastor, preacher, teacher is re-emphasizing things. The same stuff over and over, you know. I think it was Eugene Peterson's son that said, or maybe it was he's quoting Eugene Peterson, maybe, but like, every good preacher has one sermon, you know. So there's just a tautology and a repetition in any kind of teaching that you do where you're just, man, I'm just trying to hone in on this one big idea for most of my life. And obviously I think that's a big part of what Jesus was doing, and then the miracles and what he's doing are part of his teaching. And so I think there's a sense in which some of those contradictions can be reconciled in that way. But McLaughlin talks about that some, and if there are any of you who ever have any challenges with any of that kind of stuff, we can talk about any given one. Or if you'd like, I can point you to resources. There's good resources on all this different kind of stuff. That's a good question, Brad. Any other questions, y'all? Got to kind of move on tonight. But anything else? All right. Get your 5 minutes back. Love you guys. Thankful for you. Thanks for coming.